All right. Pat T, you're up, brother. Come on in. Thanks for coming out.
I always do that. I swear, the older I get, I can't remember my name hardly. And I always leave the mute on. Hey, everybody, Pat Alcoholic. Glad to be here. Good to see everybody. I feel like you guys are family. I know a lot of you on this Bronx Big Book. It's absolutely one of my favorite. Hey, Patty. Hey, John. Hey, D. Good to see you guys. Those are family people. That's pretty cool having them on the call here at the end of the year. And you know what? Whenever we're talking about a third step experience tonight, and I call it back to the cabin because the longer I've been doing and studying this textbook and having experiences with my step three experience, the more it feels like going back to the cabin. And I'll explain that as we go forward, but I sort of want to set this up a little bit. So if you've got your big book, hang in there with me because we're not going to get to how it works to chapter step three for about another 10 minutes. So don't think I have forgotten what our topic is. I haven't. But I want to set this thing up, okay? Everybody, thumbs up. You're okay with that? All right, here we go. So, in the beginning, on page 60, it says, being convinced, we're at step three. So, it sort of begs that question, which we've all considered over the time, these ABCs, which is, hey, do I have an experience of being an alcoholic mentally, physically? Do I experience the spiritual malady of my spirit? Am I convinced on B that no human power can fix what's wrong with my heart, what's wrong with my head? And that's a scary proposition. We're going to talk about that. And then C of the ABC says, you know what, Pat? If you will just dial it down and quit fighting so hard, if you will seek God, God can and will take care of business in your life. He'll take care of all this stuff. And I know you don't believe me, Pat. This is the first 100 talking to us, but it's true. God's going to do for you what you can't do for yourself. And it's going to be a bloody miracle. You're not going to believe what's going to happen to your life. You're not going to believe what's going to happen to your spirit. You're not going to believe what's going to happen to your relationships with your family, with your friends, with your spouse, with your significant other. You're not going to believe what happens with you and how you work, how you show up with your employer, your employees. You're not going to believe how you take on recreation now and a zest for living that you never had before. You're not going to believe it, but it's going to happen to you. That's part of the promises of the step three experience. But we got to get to step three. And I don't know about you, but as an alcoholic, either drunk or sober, I have resistance to playing around and turning my life over to the care of God because I'm not convinced that God is all God's cracked up to be. And so we're going to go back in time. We're going to go back to Bill's story for a few minutes, and we're going to look at Bill's experience in the cathedral. On page one, Bill is over in England. So you could just look at it. It's right before he talks about the Hampshire Grenadier, the Navy SEAL of the day, the incredibly tough-minded, tough soldier that gets, you know, he meets his match drinking a bacteria-infested alcoholic beverage. Wasn't exactly that he died from alcoholism, but he died by a beer that was not properly taking care of business with the bacteria. The point is, right above that, it talks about the cathedral experience that he has. And on page one, he says, I was part of life at last. In the midst of the excitement, I discover alcohol. Then he's going, I'm lonely, and I start drinking again. Then the second paragraph, he says, you know what? I'm in World War I. I'm shipped off to England, getting ready to be either put to the front lines in World War I, which was not a pleasant thought, mustard gas, no man's land. Literally, hundreds and hundreds of thousands of people died during this war. Awful atrocities. And he's not too excited about the whole endeavor. And so he literally goes into Winchester Cathedral and he has a moment with God. He has a moment with God. And we're going to come back to what that moment with God is like because he talks about it on page 10 and on page 12. So let's move forward a little bit and see what's happening to Bill. So Bill is describing doctor's opinion. Bill's story described pretty vividly, and there's a solution up to page 23, what the physical side of our disease looks like. Hey, I can't control how many drinks I drink. I start drinking, I can't control it. I'm no match for it. And by page 10, by page 8, and so Ebby is talking to Bill, and Ebby is bringing a solution to Bill about, hey, I have a way out of this alcoholism, Bill. I know you're not going to, I know that you don't have a solution because you're as bad off as I was. I have a solution. And he starts to impart to Bill what the solution looks like. And I'm going to sort of characterize the entire conversation. Ebby speaks to Bill about a personal encounter with God. Ebby speaks to Bill about forming a vital personal relationship with God. And Bill's first reaction to that was not positive. In fact, Bill's reaction to it on page 10 sort of sums it up, I think, pretty well. With the minister, the very bottom paragraph of page 10, it says, with the ministers and the world's religions, and he's listening to Ebby tell him about how cool God is, and he's saying, wait a minute. When I think about the ministers and the world's religions, I parted right there. When they talk about a God personal to me, that means Ebby was talking about God personal to Ebby, who was love and superhuman strength and direction. Bill said, I'm all in. It sounds great. You bet. Sign me up. No. He goes, I'm irritated at a core level in my mind, snap shut. Don't talk to me about it. I don't want to hear about it. Only an intellectual idiot believes in a personal relationship with God. The only place I could go with God is impersonal. And above that paragraph, he talks about, okay, I believe that there's a power out there, mighty rhythm underlying all creation. I could go along with that. I could also go with the fact that there's some intelligence because there's some precise and immutable laws. I could even go that far. In fact, I even believe that whoever's doing this, whatever it is, it doesn't have any limitations and it doesn't have any relationship directly to time. It's outside of time. It's outside of limitations. It is vast. It's precise. It's immutable. It doesn't change. It's constant. And there's a rhythm. There's some beauty in it. But Ebby, don't talk to me about having some kind of personal relationship with God. And Ebby, there's some literature out there that talks about it. And he's basically saying to Bill, said, Bill, I was where you were at. I had this impersonal view of God and it did nothing for me. It wasn't enough. A concept of God, a concept of just a higher power wasn't enough to relieve me, to break me out of my self-imposed torture chamber called alcoholism. I couldn't get out of there on my own. And so by page 12, Bill's starting to consider, or page 11, Bill's starting to consider what Ebby's talking about because he came from the Oxford group. So Ebby's talking about Christ. He's talking about a first century Christian experience and interpretation about who God is, and they think it's Christ. And Bill is saying, by the way, I do too, but Bill is saying, hey, I don't buy it. I don't buy that that Christ is God. Thank you very much. I could go along the line that maybe he's a great moral teacher, but he's not very well followed by the people that claim him. So I'm out. Thank you, Ebby, for playing, but no thank you. And so then it keeps on going. And he says, when I look at life and I look at all the experiences, brotherhood of man, it's a grim jest. People getting along with people, the life is better because God's in it and God's doing God stuff. I don't see it, Ebby. I don't know what you're talking about. It does not make sense to me. Can you see where Bill is at? Can you feel where Bill is at with his thoughts? Ebby's on the other side saying, no, God's personal, Bill. And Bill's saying, no, Ebby, God's impersonal and I can't get there. And say, we keep on going. And then he says to he Bill says to Ebby, I'm not buying what you're selling. And Ebby finally says to him, listen, Bill, I only got one thing to say to you. I'm not trying to defend. I'm not trying to apologize for God. I'm not trying to defend God. I'm not trying to intellectually beat you into submission about God. I'm just saying the following, Bill, and listen to me very closely, which is the second full, third full paragraph of page 11. Bill, I'm going to make a point blank declaration to you. And here it is. God has done for me what I could not do for myself. My human will has failed me. Doctors, you know, Bill, they're going to lock me up. They're going to throw away the key in battles. They're going to throw away the key in the asylum. They're putting me away. Society's going to lock me up. And Bill, just like you, I had admitted complete defeat on alcoholism. I could not beat it. I couldn't stay away from the drink. I couldn't control the drink. And then finally, he says, something happened in between me being dead and defeated and broken. Something happened. Bill, then in effect, I've been raised from the dead, raised from my current experience, raised from my current death, raised from the numbness of my heart, raised from the blindness of my spirit. And suddenly, taken from the scrap heap of life, the shame, the guilt, the brokenness, to a level of life that I've never, ever experienced. Bill, I'm not defending anything. I'm just telling you, I'm witnessing to you right here and now, what's happened to me is real. And if you want it, it could happen to you too. And there's some ways that we get there. So Bill's looking at him and he finally goes, that floored me. Bill doesn't have any more intellectual arguments against Ebby. He literally is watching somebody whose eyes have lit up, whose radiance of his character has changed. This is a new man. And he literally says, that floored me. I began to look as though these religious people were right. Here's something at work in the human heart, which had done the impossible. Question for us tonight, drunk or sober, short-term or long-term sobriety, do I need a power bigger than me? Do I need God himself to do something in my heart that will set me free? Maybe some area of your life that keeps on getting blown up, some area of relationship that you can't seem to get right. We're going to be talking about the relationship between step three and the bedevilments, the keystone decision of who we say God becomes in our life in step three and how that directly relates to the bedevilments in page 52 of step two. We're going to go there. So Bill said, here was something at work in the human heart which had done the impossible. My ideas about miracles had drastically revised right then and there. And let's see here. Never mind the musty past. Here sat a miracle across the kitchen table. He shouted, great tidings. You know what? Great tidings. Think of it this way. It's a message of hope that's based on truth. It's not a message based on a lie. It's not a message based on, maybe it'll work for you. Maybe it will. Maybe sometimes it won't. Great tidings. This is a message of depth and weight. This is a message that's founded on truth. This is a message that is repeatable and transferable to you and I in Alcoholics Anonymous in this room right here tonight. So on the top, so Bill's conclusion about Ebby's spirit is this, page 11. I saw that my friend was much more than inwardly reorganized. He was on different footing. His roots grasped new soil. The entire way that basis of life that Ebby is living now is completely different. Now, something, I'm going to fast track through this, but the bottom paragraph of 12 says this. Remember we were talking about the Winchester Cathedral experience, how Bill looked at that when he first got over to World War I into France or into England, getting ready to be pushed over to France for his assignment. Here's what Bill himself says was going on in his mind and heart when he stepped off the boat. And he's in Winchester Cathedral from page 1, bottom paragraph, page 12. The real significance of my experience in the cathedral burst upon me. For a brief moment, I had needed and wanted immutable law. I had needed and wanted a mighty rhythm underlaying all, a mighty outside of time, outside of limitation experience. No, 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 no. He said, I wanted God. His heart was crying out for God. A very personal, childlike, intimate call to God. It went way beyond reason. It went way beyond concept. I'd needed and wanted God. And there I had been humbly, in humble willingness, I was ready to have him with me. God, Come on, man, do some business in my life. I am out of solution. I am out of ideas. I am scared to death. I am shaking like a tree. I am scared for my very life. Will you please come in my life and do some God business? Bill said God came. But soon the sense of God's presence had been blotted out by the worldly clamors, mostly those within himself. Wow. And so it had been ever since. And he finishes up the conversation saying, at one point in my life, I needed and wanted God, and he came. I had some experiences with the presence of God in my life, and then I walked away. I walked away because of pride. I walked away because of rebellion. I walked away because ain't no one going to tell me how to run my life. Thank you very much. I might take you in as a cosmic consultant. I might think of you as a counselor once in a while when I need a check-in. But you are not going to run my life. No way, no how. That was his conclusion. And he walked away from an active experience with God. God, by the way, folks, did not walk away from Bill. God never left Bill. And even though Bill wasn't conscious of the God contact with God, God was there. We're going to see that later on in, as we study today. So now, something happens to Bill on page 13. He's a completely different guy. He is now talking about a God who is loving, infinite, powerful, intimate with him. And in the second paragraph of page 13, Bill says this. I humbly, remember that word that he just talked about on page 12, when the cathedral experience, where he wanted and needed God? On page 13, it looks like he's going back there. He says, I'm humbly offered myself to God. Humble is not a bad word, folks. It just means I'm calling a spade. I'm calling reality, reality. I'm calling a rule, a measure, a measure. I'm saying this is the truth about life. God, you're God, I'm not. I'm coming to you. I offered myself to God as I then understood him. And I said to God, basically, God, do what you want to do in my life. Do some God stuff. Do and make of me what you want to do. And he says, now how in the world could he unreservedly place himself under the care and direction of a group, care and direction of a lamp, care and the direction of a room, care and direction of a football, care and direction of a light bulb, all these other limiting concepts that people sometimes will have of God. I'm not making fun of it at all. In fact, I think it's where we have to start. At one point, God in my life was a rock. I was trying to find a rock that I could wash away all the shame and guilt of my life. Seriously. We all start where we start, and God is so gracious, he takes us where we come. He's not judging us. He's saying, I understand where you're at, Pat. You got a limited view of who I am. I can work with that. That's fine. And he says, Bill says, God, whoever you are and however you are, I'm all in. I'm jumping. I'm in a firefight of my life. I'm on the third, fourth, fifth story of a building, and I'm getting burned. Behind me, there's an open window, and it says, God calling me. I'm going. To stay where I am, I'm going to die. To jump, I'm not sure what's going to happen, but it's got to be better than what I'm experiencing today. I'm all in. Care and direction, that's what I'm looking for. And I admitted for the first time that of myself, I was nothing. That doesn't mean he thought of himself as a pile of dew. That's not what he's saying. He's saying when I compare myself to God and I compare myself to me, God's big, God, and Bill is small. When I look at my own life, God could do stuff that I can't do. Granted, anybody think that God can't do more than what we can do, right? We believe that. We believe that God could do more than we can do. And he's saying, I can't figure life and relationship out on my own. Without God, I am lost. Without God, I'm blind. Without God, I can't figure out how to manage my emotions, how to deal with relationships, how to think about the future. Misery and depression, they dog me. Without God, I don't have a vision for how to deal with life, how to make a living, how to be successful, how to not be unhappy, how not to be full of fear all the time. And he says the result of this I ruthlessly face my sins. Sins is a fancy word. It's a religious word, but it simply means, in the Greek language, it just means missing the mark. Did you ever miss the mark in your life with a relationship? Did you ever miss the mark in your life in terms of how you wanted to show up morally or intellectually with people? How you wanted to show up as a man of integrity, a woman of honor? I did. I miss it all day long. And this missing the mark means there's something inside of me that's calling me to something better, but I can't achieve it. I keep on falling short. I falling short. I have this moral code. I have this philosophical convictions, but I can't pull it off. I can't pull it off. I don't have the power. And so, God, whatever stand in the way of me screwing this stuff up, I want to live differently now. You have it. And I became willing to have my newfound friend. See, God is now Bill's friend. We're going to come to a word called conscious companion later on in the text. And then we're going to come to five different descriptors in the keystone decision in step three. But right now he's saying, he's just tantalizes a little bit. My newfound friend who has my back, who cares about me intimately, who is intentional about being in relationship with me, who is passionate about hanging out with me. When I wake up, he's waiting for me. When I go to bed, he's making sure I'm safe and protected. I'm going to let my newfound friend deal with all this stuff. Whatever's deep down in my heart, deep down in my head that I can't even touch, the insanity and the delusions, he could have those roots. I can't even touch them. I don't even know where they are. He could have those roots. And those branches, where it shows up in my life, in my experience currently here and now, how I manage my finances, how I manage relationship, how I show up in relationship, how I show up at work, how I show up in retirement, everything. God, have your way with me. And he came to that conclusion not because of any other reason than he saw that in Ebi it worked. In Ebi it concluded that God is good. Ebi it concluded that God is faithful. Ebi had concluded that God was gentle and kind and big-hearted towards us. Unbelievable. All right. That's enough out of Bill's story to get us sort of, you know, wet the whistle a little bit. Now we're going to jump over a little bit into there is a solution, and I want to sort of pull out some of the words just before. Let's see here, what time we got? I think we're going to be okay. We're probably 8:22 minutes. Okay, good. We're just about where I want to be. And there is a solution. There's some more descriptors on who this God is in our life. But there is a solution to what? We have to make sure we could relate to the fact that from a physical point of view that I am an alcoholic, that I cannot control the drink, that whenever time I pick it up, I don't know when I'm going to put it down. I can't control how many drinks I have or how long I'm going to be drinking. And when I'm stone cold sober, I can't pull it off. I can't stay away from the drink. I go back to it against my will. There's an insanity inside that is killing me. It takes me back to the very substance that's trying to destroy my life, and I can't stop it from happening. Can we relate to that on both the physical and the mental side, right? The problem is, up till page, you know, the middle of There's a Solution is talking and more about alcoholism, is talking about the fact that the problem centers in our minds. That's true. We have to have a transformed mind, but how are we going to transform a mind that's already broken? With a broken mind? How are we going to pull that off? So it introduces this concept of a spiritual malady. And the spiritual malady is what's driving this whole train. And the spiritual malady, in breaking it down very quickly, I am selfish and self-centered to the core. I don't want anybody to run my life except me. And I'm running it into the ground, thank you very much. And I'm going to defend it as I run it into the ground for the 2,700th time. I'm never going to back off. I'm going to continue to do it over and over and over again. The spiritual malady doesn't have a bottom. It has an infinite bottom that'll take me as far into the darkness as time will allow in my life. It's hideous. It's described as the hideous four horsemen later on in the book: terror, bewilderment, frustration, and despair. Dr. Silkworth describes it as restless, irritable, and discontent. Dr. Jung describes it as if you don't have a vital spiritual experience, something that will separate you from your current experience with God and not your knowledge of God, but have an experience with God, you're going to die. Dr. Carl Jung, that's his conclusion to an alcoholic. It's a big deal. So in the next chapter, when we get over to there is a solution, if you look at page 25, you know, just as a couple things, just real quick, the great fact and the central fact. It talks about what God's going to do in our life. These are characteristics of this God that we're going to give our will and our life to in step three. In page 25, it says that I'm going to have a spiritual experience with God that's deep and effective. God is not ineffective. God is effective. And God's going to do miracles. Central fact of my life today, God's going to do miracles in my life that are miraculous. I need miracles in the way that I think. I need miracles in the way I view things. I need miracles in my courage or my lack of courage. I need somebody to help me show up in life the way I need to show up in life. I don't know how to do it. God begins to continue and continues to do things in my life that I can only describe as a miracle. And from, you know, later on page 48, we're going to be able to see, feel, use, and direct and be part of this power of God. On page 27, Carl Jung describes as a vital spiritual experience. He says, Pat, unless your emotions and your attitudes and the guiding forces of your life are thrown out, and if you don't get a brand new set of conceptions and motives dominated in you by God, you're not going to survive. Page 28 says that we can form a relationship with God under simple and understandable terms. God does not make it too hard for us to approach him. I don't have to read a War and Peace novel about God. I don't have to go up to the top of the mountain. I literally turn into my heart and I say, God, reveal yourself to me. Age 29, but God, I'm desperate. I'm a drowning man. And I'm reaching out for a thin, small reed. And right now, God, you don't seem like you're big enough to take care of me. Have you guys ever felt that? That maybe God's not big enough to take care of what's going on in your life? I have, because it shows up like this. Worry, anxiety, fear. Really what I'm saying is that God's not big enough. It's called present-day agnosticism. Okay, so then we move forward. Then if we go over to We Agnostics, there's a bunch of stuff. I'm just going to hit a couple of them. Then we're going to be into chapter three or how it works. On page 49, God is showing up in our life as an all-powerful, guiding, and creative intelligence, and he's going to transform our mind, our heart, and our soul. He's going to begin to direct my life. On page 50, he is doing things, again, the testimony from people who have given their life to God on the bottom paragraph of page 50, that God is doing the miraculous, the humanly impossible, and they are being replaced from anxiety and fear. They're now getting a sense of peace. They're getting a sense of direction. They're getting a sense of at easiness in their soul. They go from being a being burned to the ground in their life, from collapsing from self-will, self-reliance, self-propulsion, a complete disaster. And that's being transformed in their life. In the bottom paragraph of page 50, the top paragraph of page 51 simply says this. Failure of my human resources, they found that a new power, peace, happiness, sense of direction flowed into them. Power, peace, happiness, sense of direction. Anybody not want that in your life? I want every one of those. But it's attached, which is the most miraculous thing, to a living and powerful and personal God. This happened soon after I wholeheartedly met a few simple requirements. And we're going to talk about those in step three. I used to be confused, baffled. I had my whole idea about the existence. I had futility around it. It was useless. I had a heavy going of life. I sighed in my heart. Anybody just wake up with feel like you have a 100-pound weight on your chest? That heaviness of life? Do you want it to gone? Do Do you want that gone? Heavy going of life, leaving aside the drink question, they tell why life was so unsatisfactory. And then they describe the change that came over them. And they put it in this term. When the change happened to them, they now had the experience of the consciousness of the presence of God in their life. And they say, and I say, it's the most important thing, the most important aspect, the most important relationship I have in my life today. They present a powerful reason why one should have faith. All right, let's see what else happens. On page 52, it says, you know what? I no longer can doubt this power of God. And on the third paragraph says, we saw right after the bedevilment, it says, when we solved their other problems by a simple reliance upon the spirit of the universe, we had to stop doubting the power of God, and our ideas didn't work, but the God idea did. The God idea worked for what? Well, those nine bedevilments they just talked about in the previous paragraph. I'm having trouble with my emotional nature. I'm having trouble with my personal relationships. I have misery about my future. I have depression about my current condition inside. I feel a sense of lostness. I can't seem to make a successful living. That's not only talking about money. That's talking about living. It's not about money. I know incredibly wealthy people that are miserable and depressed. I know incredibly poor people that are freer than anybody you'll ever want to meet. It's a state of mind, it's a state of spirit. How to make a living? How about feeling useless? You know what? I lacked purpose in my life. I lacked a mission in my life. Full of fear. Fear of what? Fear of everything. 100 forms of fear. We'll see that in inventory. 100 forms of fear. I'm afraid that you won't like me. I'm afraid that if you find out who I really am, you'll go away from me. I'm afraid I'm going to be lonely. I'm afraid that I'm not enough. I'm afraid that I'll never make it. I'm afraid that after I did make it, I'll lose it. I'm afraid. I have fear everywhere in my life. I'm unhappy because my life is small. Everything in my life is about me. It's centered on me. It revolves around me. And my life has gotten very small and fractured, and I'm very unhappy. And I can't seem to get out of my own way. And I can't be of real help to other people. Real help is really a cool term. It means a vital connecting agent for God, letting God do some God stuff through our lives as we impact other people's lives, as we impact situations we find ourselves in. In other words, we really do contribute. We really do contribute to life. It says, aren't these bedevilments, Pat, more important to find out what a root solution to them is? Is that much more important than anything you could ever imagine in your future? In fact, Pat, if you don't get these things figured out, you're going to die. Do you believe that? If you get things just the way you think you want them and you're rebelling and you're running your show and you're self-willing everything in your life and you get it just the way you want it, might you still die? Will it ever be enough? We're going to see that it wasn't. Even in the step three conversation. All right, here we go. On page 53, the biggest decision up to this point in the book. On the first step, we have to come to agreement. I agree. I'm an alcoholic and I can't manage my life. In step two, I have to come to a choice. The first part of that choice is be willing to believe that there's power bigger than me out there doing stuff that could actually impact my life. But the choice on page 53 is all-encompassing. And man, I'm telling you what, it is a game changer. It's all the chips on the table pushed to the center in one poker hand and no cards are up. The choice is this. I'm either going to allow God to be everything in my life or God's going to be nothing in my life. I'm either going all in from this day forward that God's going to be everything. Everything in the sense of how do I make decisions? How do I conduct my affairs? How do I move through life? I'm going to bounce it off of my then conception of God as I know God and look for His will in those areas and really, truly try to be obedient and follow. That's not a bad word. We're just going to follow the universe's law. When we follow the universe's law, good things happen. When we go against the universe's law, not so good things happen. I think we all have that experience. Page 56 says, at the conclusion of this decision that God is going to be everything, Fitz Mayo had an experience. And his experience was this. I came into conscious companionship with God, with my Creator. That's the second to the last paragraph on page 56. The barriers he had built through resisting a God personal to him were swept away. He stood in the presence, and listen how he describes God now. Infinite love, infinite power. He stepped from the bridge to the shore. For the first time, he was in conscious companionship with his Creator. Folks, we don't create the conscious contact with God. We just allow the conscious contact with God to occur. God's always been there. And he says, when you experience it, it's going to be that of a newfound friend. When you experience it, it's going to be a companion, someone you want with you, not somebody you're trying to avoid. A person that understands you from the inside out, that made you, that knows you, that is not going to judge you, that is not going to take you down, is not going to point their finger in your chest and say you're a piece of garbage. Quite to the contrary, you are my beloved. I care about you. I love you. Page 57, I've been restored to sanity. And then it says this beautiful passage. Circumstances made me willing to believe because of my alcoholic addiction and alcoholism. On page 57, the first full paragraph, this miracle of healing had simple elements, really. Circumstances made me willing to believe. I had no other choice. My life was a tire fire. I humbly offer myself to my Maker. That's a very intimate conversation. You know, in other pieces of literature, God describes what he thinks of you and me. He calls you and me. Kathy, he calls you his masterpiece. You're his masterpiece. Everybody on here is uniquely identified by DNA, and your structure is perfect. You are God's masterpiece. With care and love and infinite attentiveness to who you are. In fact, other places in other books that I read talks about the fact that God thought of you, Ricky, before you were even your mama's womb. Your entire design was already planned out. Lori, that's for you. That's God speaking to you. Selena, God's personal. God is intimate, and God cares intimately about you. You were not a design flaw. You were perfect. I'm not a design flaw. I'm perfect. God says we're his masterpiece. He says we offer ourselves to our Maker. By the way, that's a great meditation. Take the word Maker to a meditation. Where I didn't just invent that. I just said, God, would you talk to me about being a Maker? If you're my Maker, would you talk to me about that? It's a great way to learn and grow in our understanding and effectiveness of step 10. And then it says, I will know. I offered myself to a Maker, and then I knew. I'm experiencing friendship with God today. It wasn't always that way. I'm experiencing companionship with God today. It wasn't always that way. And even so, God's restored us to our right minds. And then this promise. But he has come to all who have honestly sought him. That doesn't mean I'm perfect. I have all sorts of mixed methods and mixed motives when I approach God. Trust me on that. I have all sorts of selfish stuff that's going on, and I'm fearful. And I say, God, I need you to do this for me. I don't have this altruistic, perfect ego set aside idea. I don't. But I'm honest, God. I'm coming to you. I'm coming to you. I need help. God, help me. He comes to honestly all those who seek him. When we draw near to him, and how do I draw near to God? By prayer, by meditation, by obedience, by asking, by listening, by trying, by experimenting, by failing. That's how I draw near, just like a friendship. He disclosed himself to me. It's a promise. Wow. All this is a lead up to this third step. And now we're going to rocket this thing in the next 20 minutes. You ready? Now we're ready. Sorry, it took a while, but we had to get there, right, guys? We had to get to where we got. Step 3 is the love story coming off of the page and into our heart. This is a love story from Bill to you and me as alcoholics and addicts. And now it's a love story from God to you and me. Thank you very much, Bill, for bringing it to here. I'll take over. Thank you very much, says God. I'll take over. Let's have one little classroom review. How's it working for you, Pat? Running your life on self-will, self-propulsion, self-reliance. It's a tire fire, God. Thank you very much. It's not working so well. And on pages 60, 61, and 62, it gives me an experience. I put my own name in the text and I say, how is Pat doing arranging the lights? Am I trying to make people stay put and just do what I want them to do? And then their life, my life, the drama of life will be great, says the top of page 61. Man, I'm going to run the whole show. I've got it all figured out because I'm going to be the actor, but I'm also going to be the producer. Bottom of page 60, I'm going to arrange the lights, the ballet, the scenery, and I'm going to arrange your life too. Because don't you know, I may not be able to manage my life very well, but I can certainly do a bang-up job in yours. I don't know about you, but my wife reminds me that all the time, that thank you very much, do not apply. Do not apply for the job of managing my life. And I go, got it. And then I forget it. I go, got it. Then I forget it. You got that syndrome going on once in a while? I do. And so I'm walking through my life and it says, self-will. Pat, you willing yourself to be in relationship, willing yourself to get over your bedevilments, willing yourself not to have the voices going off in your head and your emotional sidewaysness in your life, you are not going to be able to pull it off. Self-will cannot be called a success. It's an abysmal failure, Pat. It will kill everything worthwhile in your life. And it has nothing to do with the alcohol. It has nothing to do with the drugs. It has everything to do with how you're living your life. Pat. Pat. Listen up. I love you. Listen up. And so the rest of this text is saying, but I'm trying to do the right thing on page 61. I'm trying to be nice. I'm trying to be virtuous. I'm trying to be generous. I'm trying to be kind. And still people are biting me in the ankle. People are still taking cross shots against my chin. Why? Because they know that I'm not being pure. They know that I'm not really out to help them. They know that I'm just trying to arrange the lights for me. And they frankly don't want to participate. That's been my experience of life. What usually happens, second paragraph or first full paragraph 61, they show the show doesn't come off very well. What's my basic trouble? I'm a self-seeker. If I help you along the way, great. But that don't let that deter me from what my real goal is. Self-seeker. I am the victim of a delusion that I can't even touch the depths of. I'm going to wrestle satisfaction out of relationship, out of life, out of money, out of things, out of trips and experiences and exotic adventures. I'm going to wrestle satisfaction and happiness out of this. I'm going to find a way to manage it well. I'm going to do it one more time. This time it'll work. This seminar will work. This speaker will make it well work. This going to this place will make it work. And I'm looking for a solution outside of me. And God is calling me back constantly with his beautiful, tender voice. Pat, Pat, come. Come and see. Come over to me and see what you think. I'll lead you out of the cave of darkness. I'll take you to a place you've never been. Because you can't get there, son, on your own. I'm a producer of confusion in my life. It's getting worse. It's not getting better. I used to have great, great ideas and great goals and dreams and concepts and visions when I was 20 years old. And now that I'm 65, if I was living on self-will still, you know, thankfully God's had a shot at me for the last 21 and a half years to teach me a little bit about walking hand in hand with Spirit of the Universe, God of God's creation. I am his creation, and living with him in constant companionship. But I run into people who are 20, 30 years sober, and they are brittle. They're as dry as burnt toast. And they can't figure out why they're so confused in life. They can't figure out why nothing makes sense and nothing tastes. There's no taste in life. There's no zest in relationship. Everything's boring and it's a condemned mediocrity they live in. And they can't figure it out. And what do? They eat a pill, they eat a bullet. They step into the way of traffic. They die, and we don't see their graves, but it was alcoholism that killed them. I'm a producer of confusion. In fact, the conclusion, our actor is in Last of 61. I'm a self-centered, egocentric guy, Pat. That's what you are. And nothing's going to satisfy us. That's what this following paragraph really talks about. I said, God, would you explain this paragraph to me? It never made any sense. And it took me years to sort of get a grasp on it. And my current understanding of this paragraph is as follows. Our actor is a self-centered, egocentric, as people we call it nowadays. He is like a retired businessman who lolls in the Florida sunshine in the winter, complaining of the sad state of the nation. I'm complaining. All I ever do is complain. I may not say it outside because, people don't want to hear me complain all the time, so I'm going to keep it to myself. But believe me, if you saw the croton going across my forehead, it would be complain, 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 complain about you, complain about this, complain about where I live, complain about the job, complain about people, complain about who my spouse is. I'm complaining. The minister who sighs over the sins of the 20th century. And not only am I complaining, but I'm sighing and I'm judging. I judge you. I judge myself. I judge others. I am critical of everybody and everything. I'm a cynic. And all my cynicism, all my criticism, and all my judgmentalism, none of it's helping me get free. I'm just trying to get free. I'm trying to intellectualize life, and I can't figure it out. Politicians, reformers would think it'd be all utopia if they do what I want them to do. I know who should be in the White House. I know what should be going on in the country. I know what should be going on in the Federal Reserve Board. If they do it my way, we all be fine. So I'm complaining, I'm sighing, I'm wishing, and finally, I'm indignant and demanding, even when I am in the wrong. Outlaw safecracker who thinks society has wronged him for locking him up because he's stealing people's property. How dare they? And then the alcoholic who's lost all and is locked up. Whatever our protestations, that's our complaints. Are not most of us just concerned about Pat, about Pat's resentments, about nobody understands Pat, nobody cares about Pat. I'd be nice to you if you'd be nice to me. I'd care for you if you'd care for me. Boy, if you showed me some love and affection and some concern, I'll do it for you. Self-pity is running my life. Resentments. You're not doing life right. I'm arranging the lights and you're not staying in your place. And so they finally tell me two paragraphs what my problem is. There they go. Selfish self-centeredness, that's the root of spiritual malady. It shows up on the surface with fear, self-pity, self-delusion, self-seeking. We could go into another whole conversation about step four. That's where we find it. But the bottom line is this, that if you think you are any match for the master of spiritual malady in your life, the evil force that is coursing through your mind and your spirit, tearing you apart, breaking you down, filling you with shame and guilt, judging you every time you make a subtle mistake, laughing at you when you are broken yet another relationship, another commitment, another promise. If you think you're any match for that, Pat, you're fooling yourself. You're no match. Pat, your troubles are of your own making. They're not because of people around you. They're not because of others near you. They're not because of where you work. They're not because of where you live. Pat, your troubles are because you're living for self and you're trying to arrange the lights. You don't realize you're fitting into God's universe. And God says to me, son, I've got it all figured out. All I need you to be is my intelligent agent, my spearhead of my ever-advancing creation. When you let me run your life, you're going to be incredibly surprised at what you accomplish, where you go, effortlessly showing up in relationship, lovingly attentive to people who don't want to care for you at all, and able to give and give and give without expecting something in return, and not running out of energy, not running out of power. How does that sound, folks? Does that sound like something you'd want? It does for me. That's what I was looking for all my life, and I was trying to chase it. You know, I chased it with credentials and studies and advanced degrees. I thought the more I got and the more I put behind my name on a business card, in fact, it took two lines to put my credentials on my business card. I was so proud. And I felt like the scared little kid all along who was too stupid and too dumb. And when people found out that I was all a sham and I was a stage character, they were going to reject me too. And I could never let people know me. Never. Because if they found out who I really was, they'd run away from me. And I'd be all alone. And I can't have that. I'd rather have a fake relationship with somebody near me than an authentic relationship being left alone. And I didn't realize that if I get authentic with God, God makes all things new. Wow. Pat, they arise out of yourself. You're an alcoholic of an extreme self-will run riot. Pat, you're a tire fire. You don't really think so, but just take a look around. If you have any doubt, and we don't have enough time to go into it now, but page 18, the alcoholic illness inventory, first paragraph on page 18 does a pretty nice job of saying, what's your life like? Are you blowing up relationships? Are you breaking promises? Are you breaking down sweet relationships that used to be good? Tornado inventory on page 82, 83. You can take a look at that. Have you just going, look, Ma, I'm not drinking. Everything should be fine. Why are you still so grumpy at me? We got to take the lead. How come it's such a bad deal? And I'm pointing the finger at the person going, listen, you ought to be proud of me. Look what I did. Really? I should be proud of you? Proud of you for not killing yourself. Huh. Let me figure that one out. All right. We must get rid of selfish self-centeredness, Pat, or it's going to kill you. But I got news for you. It's a dilemma. You can't pull it off. You ever go to rooms where people say, I'm as selfish as the day now as the day I walked into Alcoholics Anonymous? I hear that sometimes. They'll be 10, 12, 15, 20 years sober and say, I'm as selfish as I used to be when I first walked in, but at least I'm not drinking. God help us. That's the mercy of God keeping that person sober. Wow. Do I want to live like that any longer? How about the person says, I don't know any more about God now than I did 20 years ago, but at least I'm sober. Oh, gosh. My heart cries out to that person. I want to love them up. That was never the intentions of our newfound friend and our companion who wants to be his, our conscious presence in our hearts and our lives and our mind. He wants to set us free. So what's the way out of these bedevilments? What's the way out? Bill says it's really simple. Oxford Group said it was really simple. We're going to go all in for God. We made that choice in step two. God is going to be everything. And now hereafter in this drama called life, the bottom paragraph on page 62, the keystone decision. A keystone in an arch is that top stone that holds up both sides of the branch of that archway. If the keystone falls, so does the arch. The keystone is a new concept that we're going to have in our lives. And the promise of the keystone decision is that if we will take this position genuinely and sincerely, it doesn't say with all the knowledge and wisdom of the universe, it just simply says, I'm going to do everything. All that I know about myself, I'm going to give to all I know about God. And what a bargain that is. Here's the bargain. Think about this just for a second. God, you want me. I get that. Here's what I bring to the table. Brokenness, shame, guilt, ineffective life, misery, depression, troubles in relationships, troubles in my emotions. I can't seem to make a living. I'm just knocking it out of the park, God. I'm going to give you that. And God says, done. Well, what are you going to give me, God? And God says, I'm going to give you all of who I am. I've always been here. I've always been ready. I want you to know me intimately. I created you for fellowship with me. I created for you to experience a love fest with me, which is going to spill out in your life to other people all around you. And they're going to feel the very love of God from you because I'm in you and I'm recreating your life. You're on new footing. You're in new soil. You are a new creation. You are reborn, Pat. Well, God, how give me some terms to get flesh this out for me a little bit. And I know I only have 5 minutes, right, Ricky? 5 minutes. Good. Perfect. Well, flesh this out for me. Well, I'm going to be your director. In step 11, you're going to learn to pray for the knowledge of my will and the power to carry it out. And we're going to practice that. I'm also going to be your principal. Pat, you've been trying to play president all along, and I want you to be my ambassador. I don't want you to be the principal. I want you to be my agent. I want you to represent me. I don't want you to represent yourself. You're not very good at that. And I don't want you to represent others. I want you to represent me. I want the inside of me to start permeating the outside of you. And I want to be your father, Pat. You need to know who you belong to. You're mine. You're my precious child. I have infinite love for you that knows no bounds, and nothing you can do, say, or think can ever change that. I love you unceasingly and for eternity. I am your father. That was a hard concept. Some of us didn't come up with some fathers that we're really tight with. We didn't have a good father, human father experience. Let God redesign that. And then the next thing he says, I'm going to be your employer. I'm going to be infinitely practical with you on page 63. If you'll simply stay close to me, and all that means is practice these steps, do these 10, 11, and 12, do this meditation, do this prayer, do the evening review, do the morning meditation, do step 10 during the day, be watchful. When you have fall into resentment, selfish dishonesty, and fear, ask me to remove it right now. Ask me. Discuss with somebody, make amends, turn back to me. This turning from your own way, Pat, and turning to me is everything. Turn to me. Turn to me. And I'm also your maker, Pat. You're going to experience power and peace that's going to change the way you look at today without fear, how you look at tomorrow without anxiety and worry, and how you even look at death. Folks, I had a pretty much of a brush with the possibility of death in August and September of this year. I had two brain clots and a blood clot in my subclavian vein. And then I have an aneurysm going on in my heart. And I kept wondering, I said, God, am I missing something? Am I not figuring this out? And he says, no, Pat, you're just trusting me. It's okay. I mean, because I wasn't feeling fearful. I was feeling settled. So I want to end this. This is how we overcome these difficulties. These difficulties, and Ricky, give me about 2 minutes, okay? I mean, just hang in there with me. The difficulties, when we pray out our third step prayer, it says, God, I offer myself to thee to build with me and to do with me as thou wilt. Relieve me of the bondage, the torture chamber of self. God, take me out of it. Do thy will. That's the best way out. God's will is good and it's satisfying and it's whole. That's been my experience. Take away my difficulties. What are my difficulties? Well, they're next to that step three, what I wrote down, or column three in my step four inventory. But in a nutshell, it's this. My bedevilments showing up in my life. Take away these bedevilments. Release me from these bedevilments, God. And when I bear witness to others, how did I escape these bedevilments? How did my life become new? It's because you, God, your power, your love, your way of life. Of course, I want to do your will always. Okay, folks, I want you to close your eyes. I'm going to end with a little story, and it's called Back to the Cabin. It's going to take about 2 minutes, Ricky, okay? It'll take about 2 minutes, so bear with me. Here we go. This whole conversation has been me rebelling against God. Me, self-will, self-riot, tire fire going on. And I'm like a prodigal son. I've gone to the far country and I have completely destroyed everything worthwhile in life. I have taken, taken, taken. And I have broken, broken, broken every relationship. And I've finally come to my senses. And I realize that against God and against people I love, I have not treated properly. And my only choice is to go back to God. But I'm scared of this third step decision because what if God doesn't accept me? And so I'm like a prodigal son, and I'm coming back home up the road, and I'm thinking about how I'm going to try to explain to God all my bad behavior, and how I'm going to explain to God how I'm going to try to do better. I'm going to explain to God how I'm really going to get my act together. And I got all these little arguments and little thoughts in my head, and I'm walking towards the path back to the cabin, where I see in the distance this cabin. And on the cabin, the light is on the porch. And I look down there and I see this man at the cabin's porch. And all of a sudden, I see that man coming to me, first slowly and then running to me. And the closer I get, I realize that the person that's running to me is my spiritual father. It's God the Father. It's God himself calling out to me. And he is running to me as I'm approaching him. And he gets to me, and I want to tell him how I'm going to try to be better, and how I'm going to try to be good, and how I'm not going to do the bad thing anymore. And I'm going to really get my act. And he stops me. It's almost like he puts his loving hand across my mouth and says, "Son, I don't need an explanation. I love you. You are my beloved." And he gathers me in his arms, and he whirls me around like a little child, and he puts a robe on my back, a finger of identification with him on my finger, a ring on my finger. And he ushers me into a cabin. And inside the cabin is a rocking chair, and then a second rocking chair, and a beautiful rug or just beautiful colors, and a crackling fire going on in the fireplace. And he looks at me with a twinkle in his eye, and he says, "Come sit with me." And I sit down with my Father in heaven, my first conscious presence with God. And he says, "Let me tell you how much I love you. Let me tell you all the things I have in store for you. I mean for your life from here on to be good, to be right, to be used of me, and to fill you with incredible peace. Rock with me. Enjoy this warmth of this fireside chat. Enjoy me." God bless you guys.
I love you. That's all I have for tonight.